This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Some of Nancy Burkaw's earliest childhood memories are tangled up in Alzheimer's. Her grandfather died with the disease when she was six, and her father, a neurologist, made it his life's mission not only to find a cure for the disease that had killed his father, but to prevent the disease from taking him and Nancy. In her new memoir, Brain in a Jar, Burkaw tells the story of life with her famous father and how Alzheimer's colored so many of the choices she made. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to talk about Alzheimer's from a clinical perspective, but also from a personal and familial perspective. Later in the hour, we'll be joined by the head of Fletcher Allen's Memory Center, and he'll take your comments and questions on the latest science surrounding Alzheimer's. But first, we're going to spend some time with Nancy Stearns Burkaw to learn the story of this brain in a jar. Nancy, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jane.
Would you start us off reading a little bit from your prologue?
Oh, sure. I'd be happy to. After retiring from his neurology practice in Naples, Florida, my father spent hours a day doing math in his head. Even when I was visiting, he would sit silently on his leather recliner with a calculator, verifying the accuracy of his mental arithmetic and his memory of the results. He was trying to stave off what had killed his father. He rarely uttered the name of this disease to me, reserving the phrase Alzheimer's disease for clinical use only. "What are you saving your mind for, Dad?" I often wondered to myself. "I'm here now, waiting to talk with you." On one of those occasions, he suddenly looked up from his Sudoku game and stared at me intensely. "Promise me something, gal," he said. "Anything," I answered. "Swear that you will put a gun to my head if I wind up like my father." He was dead serious. He collected guns and kept them under lock and key. He knew I could shoot them because he taught me how. Before I could speak, he leapt up from his chair. "Wait, let me get the family Bible," he said. My brain was unable to reconcile his request. It wasn't fair or logical to ask a child to kill her own parent. But I knew that fair meant nothing to my father. In 3 decades as a neurologist, Dr. Beauregard Lee Burkaw had seen young people die of meningitis faster than their parents could get them to the hospital. He had scooped uncurled gray matter off the emergency room floor, hoping to stuff it back into the heads of accident victims. He'd pulled shrapnel out of the skulls of servicemen at Clark Air Base in the Philippines during the Vietnam War. He came back in the room with a leather-bound King James Bible, which bears the names Nanny Dunlap and Nancy Scott in gold lettering. "Swear to me," he repeated. I crossed the fingers on my left hand, just as I had done 100 times as a kid, to protect me from the wrath of lying to my dad or God. Then I put my right hand on the Bible. "I swear," I said, but privately vowed to one day tell the story of the man I couldn't live without.
How old were you then?
I think I was in my early 30s.
But Alzheimer's was a presence in your life from a much, much younger age. When do you first remember hearing about or thinking about Alzheimer's?
I think when I was about 5 and my father was speaking about his father's sickness. And he was writing letters to his mother, my grandmother, and making suggestions on what she should do about the care for my grandfather. And sometimes I would read those letters over his shoulder, or he would tell me that he was writing grandmother about grandfather.
And your grandfather died when you were 6, right?
That's correct, yes.
You write in the book that at the time, at least, you perceived your uncles being very angry at your father, and that perhaps that was in part because they blamed him a little bit for your grandfather's death. Your dad was a neurologist, mm-hmm. and he couldn't stop what had happened to
right.
your grandfather.
And also, my father was arguing that my grandfather should, in fact, be put in... We didn't have memory care then, but put in a nursing home. And largely because of the toll it was taking on my grandmother. And the brothers did not like that. And very quickly after my grandfather was put in a nursing home, he died. So the other brothers were kind of connecting those links, I think disappointed in their littlest brother's decision and recommendation, and then also sad that he couldn't do anything.
Did your father share their thoughts? I mean, did he think that he should have been able to do something more?
I think in some way he did. I think ever since his father got sick, my father was in medical school at the University of Virginia at the time. I think my father became obsessed with this disease. What can I do to stop this horrible, horrible thing?
So was it precipitated by your grandfather's fall into Alzheimer's, or was your dad already obsessed with these kind of ideas before he even went to medical school?
Well, I don't know about that. I think he always wanted to be a baseball player, but that didn't work out. Because Burkhaus, in addition to having Alzheimer's, are uncoordinated. But his observation of his father, I think, made my father decide which form of medicine he would study. I think he wanted to be a general surgeon, but as he watched his father get sicker and sicker, I think it helped catapult him into neurology.
And so then he became obsessed with Alzheimer's and with brain research, both personally and professionally.
Right, right.
And in fact, that obsession carried over into how he treated you, how he taught you, kind of everything that he did with you, at least in the memoir, which mm-hmm. I realize is about Alzheimer's. But it seems like this really infused your whole childhood.
Right. I think the book is about Alzheimer's, but it's also about identity and about how your family raises you, expecting you to be this blood child of theirs, but they're also putting ideas into your head. And my father filled me with some fantastic ideas and also some utterly terrifying ideas. But I think what he wanted to do, and of course we never talked about this, so it's all, the memoir is just my feelings about growing up with this man, is that he wanted to prepare me, yes, maybe for Alzheimer's, but also for the incredible challenges of life. To be ready for death. And death was a part of our lives all the time because of his profession. And Alzheimer's is another form of death.
I'm talking with Nancy Stearns Burkhaw, and we're sharing stories and learning about the science of Alzheimer's disease on the program today. Listeners, you can join the conversation as well. We know that Alzheimer's has touched many of you. You can share your own stories, your thoughts about how it's affected your family, how you deal with the thought of Alzheimer's potentially affecting you. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Nancy, can you describe your father a little bit more? Because especially in the first two-thirds of the book, he's very hard to live with, it mm-hmm. seems like. Mm-hmm. Perhaps hard to love. Mm-hmm. Certainly hard to like in some ways.
Right. I think my father really wanted, or I think his identity was around being a maverick. You know, he just wanted to push the boundaries of everything. In fact, keeping his father's brain in a jar is emblematic of that. So whatever we did, we just did it big. We did it hard and fast and scary, like, you know, going on crazy boat rides when I was very young. And
with lots of gators.
Kayaking with alligators. I think my father, although he was obsessed with death, was also very much obsessed with life. And you gotta just enjoy it and take it all in.
You didn't always like him, though.
No, I didn't. I was scared of him, and I didn't understand how he was raising me. Not that a child should spend much time evaluating how their parents are raising them, but he didn't talk about emotions or how he felt. He was a product of his generation, a Virginian, a very, very Southern man. He was very proud of that. So I just had to try to figure things out by watching him. And as difficult as that was, it had the side effect of making me smarter. And I think he was aware of that effect he was having on me and enjoyed it.
He treated you and your brother somewhat differently, though. It seems like he thought of you as a little bit of a clone of him. And so
yes.
He was going to teach you things that he thought you needed to know because mm-hmm. you were like him, whereas your
that's
brother
right.
wasn't.
Yes. And that's all based on our appearance. My father was 6'5". I'm almost 6 feet. We both have these big lips. We have blue eyes, pink skin. I think he took one look at me when I came out and said, oh, my God, it's a Burkhaw, you know, and I better start getting her ready for what that means. And he was still trying to figure out what that means and who he was in relationship to his father. And he noted that he looked exactly like his father did. So we're three generations sort of clones. And I think my father felt that those traits that we shared to make us look alike might also indicate that we would share the same brain disease.
And in fact, he thought what his father had, he would have, and then you would have Alzheimer's.
That's correct, yes.
So did you have that sense of your own mortality that perhaps you would have Alzheimer's too from an early age?
It would occur to me there would be times my father would do something that was very confusing, and I thought, well, does he have it now or do I have it? Who's not understanding what's going on? But predominantly in my childhood, and especially when he asked me to kill him, I was more concerned about his mortality. These days, I'm thinking a little bit more about mine, but I'm only 47. I got some living to do.
Your dad asked you, though, at one point on your birthday to get a genetic test to see if you had the markers
right.
for Alzheimer's. What did you think when he asked you that?
Nothing says happy 35th birthday quite like a genetic test, right? My relationship with my father was one in such that I never fought back. He said, do this, and I did that. Sometimes I wonder why, but I think I tried to fight back a little on that. I think I said, Dad, I'd rather have diamonds. You know, I was trying to be jokey, and that nothing he hated more than when I was jokey and it was a serious subject. And he said, gal, this is more important than diamonds. This is modern science, and you will do this, and you will take the kit, which you will receive to your doctor. He will draw the blood, and the results will be sent to me, and I will call you.
And so?
And so he drew the blood. My father called me very weepy a couple of weeks later and said, you have what I have, and I have what my father had. And I said, Dad, tell me what the results were. The test is, he called it APOE. I think other neurologists might use a different name for it or pronounce it differently. And he said, you are APOE3. And I said, well, what does that mean? Give me the facts. Suddenly I became the father and he was the weepy child. And he said, well, it's a neutral. It's not an indicator nor a denier. And I said, so in fact, we don't know whether I'll get Alzheimer's disease. And he said, it doesn't matter. I know. So my father's emotional litmus test was trumping the APOE test.
We're talking about Alzheimer's today. We're talking about how it affects families, how it can infuse your whole sense of who you are, what your family is. Nancy Stearns-Burkaw has just written a memoir called Brain in a Jar. More with her in just a moment, and also stories from you, a lot of listeners, sharing their thoughts with us online at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Or you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. In a few minutes, we're going to look at what the latest scientific breakthroughs tell us about Alzheimer's disease pathology and what the search for a cure looks like. Listeners, if you have a question about research into the disease, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211 or post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. But right now we're looking at the more personal side of things, remembering that Alzheimer's affects whole families. We're hearing the story of Nancy Stearns-Burkaw, who's just written a memoir, Brain in a Jar, about her father's obsession with the disease, which runs in the family. We got a note from Molly, who says, I have a unique story to tell that I've always wanted to write about as well. The ironic thing is that I have a hard time remembering all the details of my father's forgetting. Mm-hmm. I was only 11 years old when he was diagnosed with dementia, as it was called back in the 80s. I acted as caregiver for 3 years, which had a huge impact on my trajectory in life. Lots of stress, pain, and fear, for sure, but nothing I would want to erase from my history. If I could have erased it from his, though, I would have. He was a wonderful person and would have been an even better grandparent. Mm-hmm. And Nancy, you know, you write a lot at the end of the book about how, you know, this has really affected your life as well, but that in fact you wouldn't have traded your father. Even all of this discussion of Alzheimer's, that all of the things that he taught you have made you who you are. So sympathy
right.
there with Molly, I assume.
Yeah. I wouldn't have anything different. I wouldn't have a different father. I sure wish that he didn't have to suffer and that he didn't have to spend a lot of his life worried for this eventuality. But there's nothing I can do about that for him, but I can translate that to myself and not spend time worrying and just spend time living.
Let's go to the phones. We've got a lot of callers who want to share stories as well.
Okay.
Barbara's on the line with us from Guilford. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead.
How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Thanks for taking my call. I'm so glad that you guys are talking about Alzheimer's because that does run in my family, and it's a horrible sickness, a disease that nobody wants to have in their family, but, of course, it happens. Is it hereditary? And it was just very sad to see my grandmother go downhill fast. I mean, she didn't even recognize her own kids after a while and forgetting where. She drove all the way home from Marshfield to where we lived and thought, oh, I lost my sunglasses. So she came all the way back to our house, and we told her, Grammy, they're on your head. You know, that was the first signs of, you know, the Alzheimer's. And now my dad's sister has it, and he gets so frustrated when he's talking to her on the phone because she'll just keep repeating it. And it's horrifying just to see your family members just going through this. I just hope that there's a breakthrough.
Yeah, Barbara, thanks for your call. And sorry to hear about so many family members of yours going through Alzheimer's. Let's go to John, who's calling in from Montpelier. Hi, John. Go ahead.
I was looking forward to this program when I heard it was coming. I am 91 years old, and I've been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and by two doctors, one then another, and it was a shock, and it was done very indelicately, the announcement to me. And I'm calling in about the craziness I'm experiencing around this subject. I've gotten a second opinion saying that it's been a couple of years now. I got opinions to the effect that I've remained stable since the announcement, which tends to suggest something else than Alzheimer's to the people I'm seeing. And I've gotten other statements that have a different kind of dementia that I might have eventually, that I have cognitive impairment.
Hey, John, let me ask you a question. When you think about the diagnosis that you've been given, whichever one you decide that you want to go with or some combination, how do you come to terms with the fact that your own mind may be playing tricks on you and may be deceiving you at times and that you have more of this in your future?
I guess I think about that. But I'll say this, that I am very, people agree that I'm very bright right now. And people have wanted to deny I could possibly have Alzheimer's, which may be their goodwill for me. But I don't believe it in this case. And I don't believe all diagnoses of doctors. The first doctor that gave the diagnosis sat down with me and said, I would surely go through these certain stages into, you know, classic Alzheimer's. And my other doctor said, you clearly have it. Hmm. And I asked him to go to for a second opinion, and she had another opinion and suggested that I did have a cognitive impairment. I went through a lot of tests.
Well, John, it sounds like at least right now you're faring very well and maybe looking for other diagnoses and other ways of people and doctors who can help explain why you're not experiencing symptoms that some doctors have told you will. I'm very glad to hear that you're feeling very sharp and that you are feeling like maybe this isn't happening to you. Appreciate your call and thank you for sharing it with us. And let's go to Dan calling in from White River. Hi, Dan. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm glad, too, that there's an opportunity to talk about how difficult this disease affects families. I first had visited my mother, who was living in Virginia at the time, and I noticed that her refrigerator wasn't being maintained, a lot of rotten food and this sort of thing. And that was my indication that she could no longer live on her own. Together with I noticed she had a kind of a look about her when I took her to the grocery store that she felt confused in there. So that was the first sign. That's 6 years ago. And I brought her up here to live with me in White River. I have a large family, six children, and I was anticipating that there was going to be a group effort of her caretaking, and it's turned out that the opposite's been true. Mm. I have been the sole caretaker for my mother for the last 6 years. Not even a weekend break in that period of time. She's she was enjoying a portion of her life each day, and she's steadily declined more recently. And she's, of course, incontinent, and she needs to be hand-fed. And if you didn't feed her intentionally, she just would go without food.
Dan, it sounds like that's changed your life pretty completely. Not just in what you do, but how about in how you feel? I mean, what's the emotional toll that takes on you?
It's just incredibly difficult. I have negative feelings about my own family now. I really, feel isolated. I didn't feel that back then. Now I feel like my future is someone similar to what my mother's is at this point, but I would be in a nursing home instead of looking at my family as a source of care, because they just don't. You really need to be a real caregiver in order to take this responsibility on.
Well, Dan, it sounds like you are in a really hard time, and I'm sorry to hear that. But I appreciate you calling and sharing your story. I appreciate that you're willing to open up and let people know what it's been like for you. And you are certainly not alone. A lot of other caregivers around the country trying to shoulder that burden. Nancy, what do you think?
Well, my heart goes out to Dan and his family, and what he's talking about to me is the second catastrophe of the disease. The first is the loss of the mental capacity of the person that you love, and then is the horrendous effect on the family, especially the caregiver. And if you're not a caregiver, you don't know how unbearably difficult that is. And if you're trying to shoulder it all without assistance from your siblings, or at least being on the same page, it is the second catastrophe. And then trying to decide whether you can afford to put your loved one into a memory care clinic. And that brings me to the third catastrophe, the economic problems of this disease. While we're waiting for a cure, we have some philosophical problems to resolve. Who's going to take care of whom and with what money? And if so many people are getting Alzheimer's now, but I mean, the numbers are just increasing, that means caregivers are going to have to quit work and stay home. So how are they going to finance this caregiving operation? And memory care is very expensive. My father had the foresight to have long-term health insurance. Not a lot of people can do that. So these are the waves of things that are going to be affecting so many people like Dan.
What about emotionally for you when you realized that your father did have Alzheimer's and was going downhill?
Well, of course, it wasn't a surprise. I think a lot of people, like our first caller who said, I was surprised, I'm 91, I've been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. I was waiting for the diagnosis my entire life. And in fact, as he started to get a little bit forgetful and would forget to call me on my birthday and do things, I would say often to my stepmother, it's here. She'd say, oh, no, it's not here yet. And then a year later, I'd be like, it's here. No, it's not here. So I was waiting for it to show up.
You mentioned a little while ago the brain in the jar that actually gives you the title for this memoir. And that brain in the jar was your grandfather's brain,
that's
as your
right.
dad told you.
Yes, yes.
What happened to it?
I love that question because that's the second mystery. When my father and my mother were married and we were all living in Largo, Florida, and my father had his first practice, the brain in the jar was on that desk. And then maybe 10, 15 years later, they divorced and my father remarried, shut that practice down and moved to Naples, Florida. Something happened between Largo and Naples and the brain has gone missing. I think personally that my father decided that he didn't need the brain anymore. He had a new person in his life to love, and she worked with him. She was a tech. And I think while my prime family and my mother and my brother and I were doing things like swimming and things, my father now had a new partner who was connected with him in the brain process, and he didn't need the visual anymore.
How do you think about your own relationship with your brain now and what might happen to you in the future, mm-hmm. but you don't know?
Right. My brain and I have a complex relationship. Sometimes it doesn't do as I wish that it would. But I often realize, like the past year, my father died a year and a day ago. And for the past year, I've had some problems with my thought process, but I think that's been grief. That's been doing edits on a book. I think I literally have had so much on my brain that it hasn't been able to work for me as well as it possibly could. But I'm not going to go the route of my father, who started taking 72 supplements a day and doing math puzzles. I never could do math. I'm a letters person. So maybe there's hope for me because he was a numbers person and I'm a letters person. So maybe I'll be good. But I'm just going to go forward. What can I do?
So you don't worry about it?
Maybe I should be worried that I'm not worried about it. I'm really not. I'm too busy living. And honestly, what can I do? You know, that's the question. For all of us who might be getting it, again, it's the philosophical question while we wait for this pharmaceutical cure. How will you decide how your life is going to be? My life will not be fair. And Bo taught me to be courageous. I can do this.
What about for your son? What do you tell him about Alzheimer's?
He said last night, I was on local television, and I came home and he said, Mommy, I'm scared. I'm scared you're going to get it. I'm scared I'm going to get it. And I said, let's not worry about that. And I bet there will be a cure by the time you're a grown up. But you have four other gene pools in your body. I think we've deluded you.
So basically, you don't want him to spend his life fearful.
I do not. And I'm making a point to take him to Cambodia. At age five, he was at Angkor Wat. So we're going to see the world.
Nancy Stearns-Burkaw is the author of Brain in a Jar, A Daughter's Journey Through Her Father's Memory. She'll be having a book launch party this Saturday at 6:30 at Phoenix Bookstore in Burlington. And Nancy, thank you for sharing your story with us.
I thank you very much. And I suggest calling the Vermont Alzheimer's Association when you need some support.
We appreciate Nancy being here. We're going to continue talking about Alzheimer's in just a moment. We're going to get the latest scientific research into the disease. Listeners, if you have questions about treatments and the search for a cure, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Vermont Edition. A lot of people sharing their family stories with us. Tom writes, my grandfather, who lived through the Great Depression, was a very stern and sometimes mean individual whose main concern in life was his wealth, with his family being a secondary concern. But when he was afflicted with Alzheimer's, an unusual thing occurred. He had forgotten the importance of money, and suddenly he had become his jolly old man, who was an absolute pleasure to spend time with. It's hard to believe that such a horrific disease can have this kind of effect on a person. So again, continue to share your thoughts with us. Go to vpr.net and stay tuned for more on the science and research into Alzheimer's. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We've talked a lot in the last half hour about the emotional toll Alzheimer's can take on family members. We thought we'd spend a little time as well now checking in on the search for a cure. And listeners, if you have questions about research and science on Alzheimer's disease, give us a call now at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Dr. William Pendlebury is a professor of pathology, neurology, and medicine at the University of Vermont, and he's director of both the Memory Center and the Center on Aging at Fletcher Allen. Dr. Pendlebury, thanks for being on the program again.
You're welcome, Jane.
So we've talked with Nancy Stearns-Burkaw here about the toll that Alzheimer's can take on family members. I'm just curious, before we get into some of the hard data here, how do you help patients and their families deal with all of this shrapnel, all of the associated pain that goes along with Alzheimer's?
Well, one of the more important things that we try to do is get them connected to community-based resources. So in the Memory Center, we have a dedicated social worker, and her job is to provide education and counseling around what there is in the community for patients and families to take advantage of, to provide resources for them. And the other big part of this is the Alzheimer's Association in the state of Vermont, which is very active and very well organized to help patients and families deal with all of the issues.
I spent some time on the National Alzheimer's Association webpage this morning and was reading some of the statistics and some of their thoughts. And they were saying, you know, Alzheimer's is the deadliest disease in America that has, and the world presumably, but that has no cure, no real treatment, and no prevention. Is that true?
That is basically true. If you look at the three or four leading causes of death in people over the age of 65, basically you're talking about heart disease, cancer, stroke, and Alzheimer's disease. And there have been great strides made in terms of risk reduction and prevention of the top three. But thus far, nothing has been found that reduces the risk per se or has an effect on the course of the disease when one talks about Alzheimer's disease. So I think that's basically a true statement.
Let's go to our callers. We have a lot of people who have questions for you today, Dr. Pendlebury. Jim is on the line with us from Bennington. Hi, Jim. Go right ahead.
Hi. My mother died of Alzheimer's in January this year. And I wanted to ask you about what information or knowledge you have with respect to patients who have been taken too deep in anesthesia and later onset of Alzheimer's. I can tell you that my mother had a partial pancreatectomy in 1997. And from that day forward, she was never the same. Never. There was always a twinkle of mischief in her eye from my earliest memories, but after that operation, no more.
Any correlation with deep anesthesia?
Only in the sense that people who suffer what might be called traumatic events, including surgery, anesthesia, other kinds of injuries — I wouldn't describe anesthesia as an injury, but an event — may unmask pathology that is already brewing in the brain that is due to Alzheimer's disease, and therefore may bring attention or increase the likelihood of clinical symptoms becoming apparent after an event like that. But beyond that, there's no known association or causal relationship between anesthesia, falling down and breaking your hip, or other events like that that sometimes unmask Alzheimer's disease that wasn't apparent before the event occurred.
When you say unmasked, do you mean it just becomes more visible, or does it somehow sort of make it happen faster?
I'm not sure it makes it happen faster. Maybe people who are going through a major surgery, who are having anesthesia, are being observed more carefully, so symptoms become more apparent than were realized before the event occurred.
We got a note from Christine in Bolton who says, "My mother started showing symptoms of Alzheimer's at age 58. She's now 67, has severe symptoms where she requires a modified textured diet, is no longer ambulatory, and is, I presume, at the end stage of the disease. I know that early onset Alzheimer's can be more genetic than the late onset type. I have 5 siblings, and we are all concerned about developing the disease. Is there any testing that you could recommend that we could undergo in order to ensure that we, A, have an early diagnosis, and B, could start on some preventative type of medication to reduce or halt the symptoms of the disease?"
So I think the first thing is to understand that when one talks about early onset Alzheimer's disease, we're talking about two different things. So there are people who develop regular Alzheimer's disease that is not genetically determined at an early age, and that sometimes is referred to as early onset Alzheimer's. And then there is a genetic form which is called early onset familial Alzheimer's disease, and that is caused by several genetic mutations that do significantly increase the risk of family members to eventually have the disease as well. But families in which there is early onset non-genetic Alzheimer's disease don't really have any increased risk over families whose family members may have developed the disease at late onset. In terms of any testing, there's none that's currently recommended for family members of patients who have early onset disease. The best advice that I can give anybody in these families is to live a healthy lifestyle, maintain good intellectual exercise, regular physical exercise, good nutrition, good social contacts. No medications are currently available that a person can start taking to reduce the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease, and certainly no supplements or over-the-counter type remedies that are advertised on a regular basis have been found to be scientific study have been found to be useful.
So you don't advocate patients of any stripe going in to get a genetic test to see whether they have any markers that would suggest they have a predisposition to Alzheimer's?
I don't, and neither does any leading expert throughout the United States. Certainly, if you were in a family that had early onset familial Alzheimer's disease, where we do know there are genetic mutations, that kind of testing is available, but it has to be done under very careful circumstances with the appropriate support and counseling, because if you learn that you have the gene, then you have 100% likelihood of getting the disease, and that can be very difficult to deal with, obviously.
Can you talk then a little bit about the research that's going into determining future treatment for Alzheimer's? Because some of what I've been reading is that it is associated with catching it before you have symptoms. And wouldn't that require some sort of testing before you know whether your brain is failing or not?
Right. So I think where the research is going in Alzheimer's disease currently is to try to find ways to identify the disease before it develops clinically. And we now are pretty certain that the pathologic changes of Alzheimer's disease begin about 20 years before a person actually has any symptoms. And we can see that certainly in research settings by doing what are called biomarkers. So analyzing cerebral spinal fluid, looking at very sophisticated brain imaging such as high-resolution MRI and PET scanning can identify people who have the pathologic changes, and as long as 20 years before they have any clinical symptoms of the disease. The problem is that we haven't yet got to the point where we can be 100% certain that a person who doesn't have pathologic changes won't get Alzheimer's disease, or 100% certain that a person who has pathologic changes will get Alzheimer's disease, nor do we have any effective treatments yet to intervene at that point. But that's where the field is currently going. I think 10, 15 years from now, maybe sooner, it'll be a reasonable approach to identify somebody who's destined to get Alzheimer's disease and intervene to prevent the disease.
What kind of research is being done that leads to a kind of a treatment? What might that treatment look like?
So we think there's pretty good evidence that a protein called amyloid, more specifically A-beta 42, is the culprit that causes Alzheimer's disease. It causes neurons to die and it causes synapses to be destroyed. And what people believe, what researchers believe, is that if we could find a way to get that protein out of the brain before too much damage is done to neurons and synapses, then the disease would be prevented. We currently have some of those drugs available, but so far they've only been tried in people who already have Alzheimer's disease clinically. And in people already suffering or dealing with the disease, the drugs don't work. There's actually a study about to begin in people who have the genetic form of Alzheimer's disease who are 20 years from when they're going to get it, and a new clinical trial is going to be done in people like that to see if the drugs that currently are not working for people who have Alzheimer's disease will work if you start 20 years before they get the disease.
But we're not going to know the results of that then for quite a number of years.
It's going to be a little bit of time before we know the results of that.
Let's go to Lynn, who's waiting on the line from South Burlington. Hi, Lynn. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My dad died about 2.5 years ago, presumably from Lewy body dementia. And I'm wondering if are there tests that could be done for my sibling and me and for my children to determine our genetic predisposition or not to Lewy body dementia and Parkinson's? And also the research that is being done on Alzheimer's, is that directly applicable to Lewy body and some of the other dementias like frontotemporal dementia and CBD and that sort of thing?
Lynn, thanks for the call. Dr. Pendlebury.
So Lewy body disease or Lewy body dementia is probably the third leading cause of dementia in people over the age of 65. There are no specific tests that would identify it in a family member who may be predestined to develop Lewy body disease 10 or 15 years from now. I'm not aware of any testing like that. So I think the answer to the first question is no. With regard to the research that's being done in Alzheimer's disease having applicability to other forms of dementia, I think that also is probably the simple answer is no, that it doesn't have any applicability. But you never know when you're looking into one disease what relevance it may have for understanding another disease's mechanism or cause. So at the moment, most, at least what research I know that's being ongoing in Alzheimer's disease doesn't really have much applicability to dementia with Lewy bodies or to frontotemporal dementia.
So different dementias have different causes in the brain, even if the symptoms on the outside may often be fairly similar.
Correct.
We got a question from Jennifer who says, I've read new studies that suggest that Alzheimer's could be diet-related, a kind of type 3 diabetes where the problem is insulin resistance in the brain. Dr. Pendlebury, what do you think about those studies?
There's some relatively small amount of evidence that this notion that Alzheimer's disease is really diabetes type 3. It's based on limited studies. It is true that the brains of patients with Alzheimer's disease do show insulin resistance. How that relates to how the disease actually progresses and what other cofactors may be involved is not entirely clear. So I think it's a little premature at this point to label Alzheimer's disease as diabetes type 3. It's certainly not a mainstream concept at this point.
And we got a note from Will here at VPR who says, my father had Alzheimer's, as did his mother, we believe. Is there any credence to the studies that indicate that it's passed on maternally only?
No.
So no sense that it's just maternal, any sense that it's genetic other than what you describe as the familial Alzheimer's?
So the sporadic form of Alzheimer's disease, which is overwhelmingly the most common form of Alzheimer's disease, is associated with what we call susceptibility genes, and we all have susceptibility genes for different diseases. We have susceptibility genes for colon cancer, for heart disease. So assuming that it's probably likely that people who have more susceptibility genes for Alzheimer's disease have a higher risk of getting the disease. However, not all of the susceptibility genes have yet been identified.
You know, we were talking earlier in the program about the strain that this has on families, and we got a call from Dan, who's the sole caregiver for a family member with Alzheimer's. And, you know, again, the Alzheimer's Association says that Dan's not alone. This is a huge problem, huge numbers of caregivers, 15 million caregivers, spending about $216 billion last year in unpaid caregiving. So this is a huge issue. You know, millions of Americans suffering. Is enough research being done? I mean, are you confident that everything that can be done to find a cure is being done?
I'm optimistic that the federal government is beginning to pay much more attention to this disease and is throwing much more money at research for understanding the cause and prevention of the disease, including drug development. I think we could be doing more. I think I'm correct when I say that last year $600 million was spent on HIV research, and about less than half of that was spent on Alzheimer's disease. I think we can do more, but I'm optimistic that the federal government is beginning to recognize the need for that.
So do you see hope in this brain mapping project that was announced yesterday?
I think the jury is out on that at this point. I know that Barack Obama had a lot to say about that and its relevance for Alzheimer's disease and other brain diseases. But I think I'm taking a wait-and-see attitude in terms of how that's going to contribute to our understanding of Alzheimer's disease.
Dr. William Pendlebury is a professor of pathology, neurology, and medicine at the University of Vermont, and he's the director of both the Memory Center and the Center on Aging at Fletcher Allen. Dr. Pendlebury, always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Listeners, we do have resources up at vpr.net/Vermont Edition if you want more information, and you can continue to share your thoughts there. Lots of people talking about what effect Alzheimer's has had on their family, and you can add yours. That will do it for today's show. Tomorrow, shoreline protection. Last week, the Vermont House passed a bill which would require all new construction within 250 feet of a lake shoreline to get a permit. The bill aims to protect water quality, but opponents say it imposes too much of a burden on small property owners. We'll discuss, and you can send your comments or questions about shoreline development and water quality to VermontEdition at vpr.net. Our producers are Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Tim Johnson. Peter Biello directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.